Good evening. I'm Tom Bacon here with a brand new work for The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. If I had any money, I'd bet some of it that you never heard of a writer named John Graves. I hope to rectify that by sharing one of his later works called From a Limestone Ledge, a book which is really a collection of anecdotes from his life on a small ranch in the Texas Hill Country, a ranch he named Hardscrabble. Those who know about such things consider From a Limestone Ledge the third leg of a trilogy that Graves composed about rural Texas life, the first being Goodbye to a River, his account of how damming up the Brazos River would destroy the stream which meanders down from North Texas to the Gulf of Mexico, and the second called Hardscrabble, stories about living on and struggling with his ranch. The topography of the land he loved and hated and described resembles the Palouse in some ways. It's basically flat, but rolling and humped as far as one can see. Trouble was, by the time he got there, the Brazos Valley land had been misused for years by cotton farming and cattle grazing, and once abundant topsoil had been stripped away down to the limestone bedrock in many places. Graves strikes me as an interesting combination of human types. There's some good old boy underpinning to his professorial and deep-fried philosopher tendencies, and there's even a whiff of hippiehood from his years spent rambling across Europe doing not much of anything. Graves lived a long time. He was 93 when his life ended in 2013, and he had lived through more adventures than many of us can even fantasize about. He was a Marine in World War II and was blinded in one eye fighting on the Pacific island of Saipan. He was a graduate of what's now Rice University, and once he settled down at Hardscrabble, he taught English at TCU in Fort Worth for a number of years. So please join me now in stories about life viewed from a limestone ledge, a work by John Graves published by the University of Texas Press. Chapter 1 is entitled Notes of an Uncertain Blue-Collar Man. "The hell with it," said the 17th-century specialist. "I spent 9 years working on a Ph.D. and 15 making full professor, and here I am shoveling rocks out of a ditch. I'm moving back to town." "Ah, you don't mean it," I said, visitant free labor, leaning on the pick that had loosened the rocks of which he spoke. He managed to grin. "I guess maybe not. But one of these times I will. No figures exist, nor is there much demand for them, but I suspect that electrical malfunctions, leaky roofs, busted pipes, jammed sewers, rampaging storm waters, and the like, have more bearing on the number of back-to-the-landers who eventually return to the cities than do other strong factors, like wifely lonesomeness and the generally dismal economics these days of a functional existence on the land. Not that city dwellers and suburbanites don't have to face similar troubles in their brick veneer strongholds, but they don't have to face them quite so squarely and quite so miserably alone unless they choose to. Nor is the possible range of problems half as extensive in town as out here among the hoot owls and the coyotes. Consider, if you will, the question of human waste, to designate it by one of the numerous euphemisms which have been tailored for it and which attest to its grubby importance. Except for anal stage babies and certain happy coprophiles and a billion or so third-world subsistence farmers, not many people have much affection for the stuff, but it is one of the more central facts of life. A scant century ago, if that much, and let's not stray into debates over probably mythical Thomas Crapper and his invention and all that, Western man devised a means of whisking the substance out of sight and mind so fast that for most of us, most of the time these days, it's possible to pretend it doesn't exist, except as a source of metaphor. Whether this evasion is good for us philosophically is an unresolved question. Whether it's good for our world is all too easily resolved on the nay side, as a boat trip down any stream that has to absorb even standardly treated mass waste will show. But that's a social problem, not a personal one, unless you happen to live too close to the bank of such a stream or like to go on boat trips all the time. The average urban or suburban householder can keep his mind on higher things like bass lures and Archie Bunker, except on rare occasions when T. Crapper's invention backfires or tree roots clog the shorthouse sewer that connects him to the public main. And on those occasions, he can call a nearby plumber whose charges are theoretically kept within reason by competition from hordes of other nearby plumbers, and with spouse, offspring, and intact dignity, can quit the house until the trouble's been fixed and the air has cleared. Not so in the boondocks. Here flows no public sewer main, but instead an intricate disposal system, consisting usually of a septic tank or two, whose population of friendly bacteria digests solids, a second euphemism, although it includes other matter that gets flushed too, and a field of tile or perforated plastic pipe to disperse into the soil the clear effluent that results. Indigestible sludge results also, building up slowly in the bottom of the tank. This system isn't often a social problem, but belongs to the sturdy householder alone. It costs huge heaps of money to install, and if he neglects it, letting sludge accumulate to the point that it spills over and clogs his disposal field, it costs heaps more to get it back into service. Hence, a returner to the land, after one or two sour experiences, is likely to spend a portion of his time digging down to inspection boxes to lift their lids and make certain his effluent is unclouded, or searching about for damp, fragrant spots in the grass that hasn't been rained on in weeks. And after a couple of other sour experiences with the payment demanded and received by one of the scarce and uncompetitive plumbers willing to drive out from a town and view his troubles and maybe cope with it, he's likely to spend a good bit more time manipulating a pick and shovel, and certainly more specialized implements such as snakes and sewer rods. Spouse and offspring may leave the premises with dignity at such times, and usually do, but not he. Few of us neo-rustics, or paleo-rustics either, have the fortitude to tackle a sludge-packed septic tank on our own. We call in a professional with a tank truck and a large bore suction pump, who gets revenge for the general unpleasantness and lack of social cachet attached to his job by charging hell out of us. But most of the rest of it we learn how to do because we have to. So, too, do we learn about water systems that begin in the bottom of a 200-foot well and progress through pumps and pressure tanks to an underground network of leak-prone pipes running to far-flung cattle troughs and kitchen sinks and what-all, with swarms of differently sized and functioning valves and outlets along the way, and about high lines, ground rods, breaker boxes, and shorted motors, and diversion ditches and chimney flashings and one-lung gasoline engines and termites, and even such mechanisms as water heaters and automatic washers, though with some of those latter you have to do the laborious alternative of detaching the offending object from its moorings, wrestling it aboard your pickup, and hauling it to some city shop that will not stick you more for repairs than it sticks insouciant townsmen. In the course of this education, you acquire a half-ton or so of parts and fittings just in case you need them, and boxes and shelves and walls full of tools, a good many of which you never even heard of before you headed countryward, and some few of which you'll use exactly one time in your life. Because, for instance, on the one sole occasion you had urgent need of a 1¼-inch crow's foot wrench and nowhere to borrow one. All for the dubious privilege of leading a technological life in a place where it possibly doesn't belong, and all aside from other technological maintenance and ingenuity with which your pursuit of agriculture, if any, may embroil you. The only true alternative would seem to be a return to the simple, forthright ways of old, which, for that matter, are still pretty much the ways of most of mankind. Privies and water buckets, mules and mussels, handcarts and firewood and oil lamps or candles. Most of us who go to the country from a city background have some nostalgia for these ways, even if it only manifests itself in a wagon wheel hung over the gate and an expensive fieldstone fireplace and a deluxe edition of Walden on the coffee table. and a certain number of us believe on principle that the old ways were more honorable in basic terms, since they fed on local renewable resources and individual effort and didn't gnaw at the earth's guts and disrupt the complex, rich flow of its processes. Not, of course, that some old ways of farming and grazing and hunting meat haven't been hugely disrupting the scheme of things since way back in prehistory. Yet, except for the very pure and young and vigorous homesteaders of the Mother Earth persuasion, may God bless them one and all, the old way alternative is a very tough one. Rewiring a barn and unstopping a sewer and sweating joints and copper pipe are small potatoes in terms of effort and, above all, of expended time, when compared to the endless hauling and pounding and scrubbing and lifting and digging and chopping that characterized the daily lives of most of our rural ancestors, unless they were landlords with serfs and peasants to command, or else the hard-headed fathers of large families. Or Henry David Thoreau, who had only his own basic needs to look after and could dine with friends in Concord when he felt like it, as according to recent report he rather often did. We have tasted the fruit of that tree and found it sweet. And technology seems to be with us, even if there's room for a little hope that in time it may grow less destructive. Few women, having grown to use a Maytag, are willingly going to boil dirty clothes in a washpot or carry them down to the creek and flog them clean on stones. And while there must be folks who consider a January outhouse where the north wind whistles cozily about one's private parts preferable to a heated bathroom, I haven't spoken with any of them lately. Hence, stuck, one copes or one goes back to town. Most of us end up coping most of the time and paying through the nose for help when we can't. And most of us also end up taking a perverse pride in the acquisition of such blue-collar skills, since it represents survival in a way of life we've picked. In the company of others eaten by the same disease, be they academics, Baptist preachers, businessmen, hairy dropouts, or actual born countrymen, we can always find a bridge for conversation in topics such as PVC drainage systems, tick invasions, and the merits of jet versus submersible pumps, and can brag to a discerning audience, impatient to start bragging themselves, about times when we've tracked down and rectified esoteric troubles. The high point of my own career in this respect came one winter day after an ice storm, when turning on the electric range mysteriously caused various lights in the house to come on and flicker dimly. By deduction, and much snapping of switches and breakers, and an uneasy rejection of my wife's theory of poltergeists, I traced this phenomenon to a meter pole split bolt connector loosened by the ice's weight and jiggling in the wind that was intermittently letting the juice from one of the range's hot wires flow out through the... Well, never mind. It was a trifling sort of triumph, but it was mine alone. You can go for months without much trouble, then have 10 different sorts of it in a week, all urgent. I won't pretend that under such assaults pride doesn't often succumb to weariness and anger, especially as the years pile up on your back. You're supposed to be whatever it is that you are, in my case a writer, and you find that you've ended up a part-time, unpaid, and often unthanked jack of all manual pursuits. It's possible at such moments of realization, like my professor friend, to consider quitting or to yearn back illiberally and quite vainly toward a class society that would furnish you with a smart peasant or two or three to do such work and allow you in the established manner of patricians and intellectuals to take pride not in the grubby blue-collar skills, but in soft hands and happy ignorance of how things function. Not that such wishfulness does much good when 11 heifers are bawling their thirsty heads off at an empty water trough, and finding and patching the cause of its emptiness is up to you and nobody else. And not that it usually lasts long. You go ahead and cope because you choose to be where you are and still like being there, and the coping is part of the bargain, and in it, too. You attain sometimes the pleasant illusion, rare these days, of dominating the world around you, technology and all. And here we begin chapter 2 of John Graves' From a Limestone Ledge. He subtitled the book, Some Essays and Other Ruminations About Country Life in Texas. Sure enough, chapter 2 is one of his essays. He called it, More Than Most People Probably Want to Know About Fences. In his pleasantly irascible and intricately inquiring Adventures with a Texas Naturalist, the late Roy Bedichak lodged a complaint against the Encyclopedia Britannica for its skimpy and lackadaisical treatment of the subject of fences, noting that the article on fencing, in other words, swordplay, is given about 9 times as much space. I haven't checked the August EB's latest edition, but for the vintage one I own, the notation is accurate. And as a student of fences over a period of years, I share Bedichak's resentment of this virtual dismissal of a major rural topic. I don't share his opinion as to its cause, however. In line with the testy sort of prairie populism that, in his own way, he embodied, he attributed the slight to aristocratic bias, catering to the quality, whereas to me the prejudice exhibited, if any, looks not so much upper class as urban and academic. For the fact is that most of the quality during history have derived their main sustenance and reason for being from the ownership and administration of rural land, and therefore fences have loomed as large and worrisome for them as they have for peasants and yeomen and whatever you want to call the rest of us bucolic sojourners. In 2/3 of our own sweet realm of Texas, for instance, if you went around looking for something that resembled a native aristocracy, the closest you would come would be the hereditary owners of large ranches who were paid the compliment of imitation by many of our newly rich. No one on earth is more fanatically obsessed with fences than a rancher. Nor do I think that the old-world descendants, spiritual and literal, of medieval lords of the manor and 18th-century squires can lag very far behind in their concern. The big problem that fences cope with, or are supposed to, is, of course, most domesticated animals' flat distaste for staying where you want them to be. True, some fences are erected to keep people in or out of certain premises, but they're fairly useless for this purpose unless backed by armed might, as East Berlin wall guards could tell you, or any small rancher in deer-hunting country. Owned beasts require some degree of management for their own good, for the protection of planted crops and other things, for the maintenance of peaceable relations with neighbors, and in such management the ultimate tool is the fence, be it structured of wire, wood, stone, or living thorny things. Not that it's the only tool. Under primitive conditions, a main country occupation has been and still is that of the herder, guiding his charges through their daily perambulations and fending off Mother Nature's waiting teeth and claws. You can still see lots of them in places like Mexico and North Africa, where conducting 42 goats about the rocks and brush is rightly considered a better job than none at all. But in richer lands like ours, where our wage cash has become the major gleam in the collective eyeball, to afford such methods in their purity these days, you need to be either very rich and a romantic yearner back toward simpler times, when cowpokes and longhorns thundered about the open range, or else the owner of a large number of vulnerable creatures under special circumstances, such as the immense migratory flocks of sheep that graze western public lands under the sage eyes of imported Spanish-Basque pastores. Lingering traces of fenceless times do show up here and there among lesser Americans, some of them quite interesting. Here in my own region, only a few years back, a family of unmarried brothers of the sort known locally as Big Old Boys, though none was under 40, inhabited and operated a few hundred acres of ancestral land, which was mainly rocky hills. Fond of hounds and hunting and fishing and hooch, they shared an aversion not uncommon toward the more or less endless maintenance that venerable fences like theirs require. Such effort as they occasionally expended in that direction went into restapling and sometimes splicing and half-heartedly restretching the 3 rust-rotten heirloom barbed wires that guarded those parts of their place's perimeter where neighbors had not built something better. Cross fences within the place itself they ignored. Since they did some farming in creek bottom fields near the house and also ran about 3 times too many motley and ravenous Part Brahmin cattle on their hills, this neglect could have proved troublesome. But they made up an ingenious game to counterbalance it. Though all were good riders and ropers, they seldom used those skills except when working calves. What they did was set up a sort of sentry post on the front porch, which commanded a view of the fields. During the growing season, one of them would usually be sitting there with a full choke 12-gauge and a supply of shells beside him, and when some intrepid bovine nosed too close to the rows of growing corn or milo, he'd select a cartridge, No. 8 birdshot for close range, bigger stuff for further out, and would loose a well-aimed blast. It was a kind of training process, and it worked pretty well, give or take a few perforated ears and eyes among the trainees. A neighbor of theirs told me one February that he had lately gone down to inspect his lush oat patch, which lay against the brother's lower boundary. "I got a good net fence there," he said, "but I looked over at it and seen a place where a big old deer or something had knocked the steeples loose, and it was laying down on the ground. And just about the time I seen that hole, here come one of them old boys, old Bony Brimmers, and she seen it too. But then she noticed there was green stuff on the other side, and she throwed up her tail and turned around and run like hell back where she had done come from." However, most of us who have saddled ourselves with the ownership of land and livestock have less poetic imaginations than that, along with maybe less time for sitting on a porch with a gun. We need fences, good ones, or at any rate as good ones as we can afford in terms of money and or personal effort, for this matter of quality of fences is very relative. At one extreme, there is perhaps those brothers' 3 sagging brown wires. At the other is the solitary and permanence of masonry, and I doubt that a stockman exists who would not like to have his place surrounded and crisscrossed with thick, high stone walls if this were feasible, as indeed it used to be for patrician landowners in undemocratic times and places, where the fences they ordered built are often still upright. A couple of years back, a young friend of mine made a 40-mile horse trip with some vaqueros in an unmodernized part of Mexico where all the big ranches were fenced with ancient 5-foot walls of stones laid dry, without mortar. A difficult art, since strength depends on the mason's skill at bedding the rocks against each other and utilizing cumulative weight to bind them into place. There were hardly any gates, and when a party in its cross-country crow's flight course came to such a barrier, the vaqueros would dismount, carefully make a gap in the wall, removing stone after stone, would pass through with their horses, and then, as carefully, would build it back again before proceeding. Such bred-in craft and patience with rockwork are common south of the Rio Bravo, and show up here to many a yard-proud Texas country lady's delight in quite a few of the amiable wetbacks who labor these days in our landscape. But there's little likelihood that even very rich hobby-style farmers and ranchers are going to be able to fence much more than their yards with stone in times like ours, wetback labor or no. 130 years ago, long before barbed wire, German immigrants in the hill country of south-central Texas were proud of their new farms and heartily disliked the open-range system that let other people's kine wander upon them at will. So they often built rock fences, doing it themselves if they were poor and had big families to help, or, if more prosperous, hiring it done. The going price was $400 a mile. That was an era when daily wages for hard, long labor ran to $1 or considerably less. I don't believe I'd want to examine a translation of those costs into the terms of today. Just the stone, if you had to buy it at prevailing prices in bulk, could run you $8 or $10 per linear yard of fence. Like stone, other traditional forms of fencing are aesthetically pleasant, especially to the eyes of city folks recently enamored of land. However, they cost a lot themselves and have some other drawbacks. A board fence around a horse paddock or a little mowed house pasture can be a handsome thing, but rot and warpage begin their work not long after the last nail is hammered home, as do the contrary beasts that the fence is intended to confine and shield, who knock planks loose or splinter them with regularity, either because there's greener herbage on the other side or simply for the hell of it. Not to mention all the repainting required. Similar problems affect picturesque rail fences, whether of the zigzag worm type favored by our ancestors to protect their patches of cropland, or the fancier straight-line post and rail sort. I believe the prettiest of these latter I ever saw was in the fox-hunting Piedmont country just east of the Blue Ridge, where non-Virginian money and taste have combined to preserve a reasonable facsimile of the 18th-century Old Dominion landscape, if you ignore a bit of pavement and a few Ferraris and such. It consisted of 2 feet of masterfully dry-laid stone in which were embedded the upright post, with 2 split chestnut rails strung between each pair of them and neatly mortised into holes. But the main reason it controlled the nervous hybrid hunters in the pasture it enclosed was a single electric fence wire fastened inconspicuously to insulators along the inner side of the top rail. Thank you for joining us on the bookshelf. I'm Tom Bacon. This has been a reading on the bookshelf of From a Limestone Ledge by John Graves, published by the University of Texas Press. The bookshelf is a program of Spokane Public Radio. Vern Windham, executive producer.